trusty money remains the bedrock of stability. The soul of money is trust.
I think we are not paying sufficient attention to the law of unintended consequences.
In the immortal words of the Doors, the time to hesitate is through.
Vlad, how you going, man?
Hi. It's really good to see you. I mean, not see you, but hear you and meet you in person. This is the Discovering Bitcoin show, which I think is really exciting because it tells personal journeys of people. But I'm going to stop doing your job right now. Just do the introduction.
No, that was brilliant, mate. To be honest, that's more of an intro, I think, that I've done on the, that anyone's ever done on the pod or I've done on the pod. It's usually just cut to the chase, say g'day, and off we go. So to that end,
you need a catchphrase like when I do my show, I say that, hello there, welcome to the Bitcoin Takeover podcast, I am Vlad, your Bitcoin influencer. Today I'm talking with blah blah blah. So I do this, and it sticks in the back of the minds of the people who listen to more than one episode.
Yeah, I need like a tag or
you
something.
You need one of these.
Develop a tag, something sort of like a radio frequency, like 105.3 or something like that. I'll give it some thought, man. But for now, I'll just say hello and ask, how did you discover Bitcoin?
Oh, man. So imagine this 21-year-old kid from Romania who never really understood anything about financial censorship and not being part of the global financial system, who has had a bank account since he was 14 for some reason to receive his allowance, and gets on the internet. I have been on the internet since I was 10 or something. So for most of my life, I have been an internet user. Mm-hmm. I got on the internet. I read about this Bitcoin thing in 2013. I was 21 years old, and I thought, this is stupid. This is the dumbest thing I've ever read about. Why would anyone want to use this? I have a bank account. I can send money to anyone I want. Why should I care? This is some crazy libertarian utopia. The government is going to ban it. How the hell can this even exist? What's the point? And then I just closed the tab where I read about it, and I stopped caring for about another year. When I read about it again, the price had gone up. Then there was a bear market. They said it was dead. Obviously, it did not die. And a year later, I read about it once again, but in a different context, because I was doing an exchange program in Paris. And one of the professors who was teaching a class in advocacy and innovation told me to do a presentation in front of the class. Obviously, it was a group presentation with two other colleagues. Mm-hmm. And this one was about Bitcoin and blockchain. And I actually had to research Bitcoin to make a presentation in front of the class and explain to them how it works and why it's important. But I still didn't buy any Bitcoin because I looked at the price and it was like $250 in 2015. It was like the bottom of the bear market. And I was like, yeah, this is about half of my rent. Back in 2015, I was paying 500 euro to live outside in the outskirts of Paris. And I was just a broke student. I didn't have much money. I had no idea you could buy a fraction of a Bitcoin. And I guess even if I bought some Bitcoin, I would have sold it maybe for a $10 profit and be very happy about it. So I did not buy any, even though I had all the information and I had every excuse to buy it. But what was happening at the time was that I was reading articles about Ross Ulbricht and his double life sentence, and that was somehow being presented in mainstream media as being associated with Bitcoin. And I was a bit frightened. I was 23 years old at the time. As you know from Blink 182, nobody likes you when you're 23. And Bitcoin didn't like me either at the time. So I did not buy. A year later, I actually had some savings. And I was like, let's look into this Bitcoin thing once again. Let's buy some. And I did look into it. And what I saw was an article which was on the front page of, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, if I'm not mistaken. But it was, regardless, maybe it was Financial Times. I was reading a lot of this stuff at the time when I was in university, a lot of mainstream financial media for whatever reason, also The Economist. But what they were saying on the front page of their website was that Bitcoin was a failed project, according to this former core developer named Mike Hearn. And in January of 2016, Mike Hearn has had this rage quit moment where he decided that he no longer wants to work on the project. And he went to the media and he said, yeah, Bitcoin has failed. The reason why he said that was that he was pushing his own fork of Bitcoin, which was called Bitcoin Classic. And it was a big block fork of Bitcoin. And since he could not politically push for that, and he did not get traction from the community, he assumed that any other proposal is wrong. So he left like that. And when I read that, and I had none of this context, which I just presented to you, I was like, yeah, so I guess I was right all along when I did not buy it. So whatever, I have my savings. I guess I'll buy some. I have no idea what I bought with that money. I wasted it on something. Since I don't remember, it was probably not important. So next year, in 2017, the price had once again reached $1,000, which was the previous all-time high. And I read the news about it. And I was like, man, there's this disconnect between what the media is telling me and what the market is doing. So is it the market that's wrong, or is it the mainstream media that's wrong? Am I being misled here? So this was the first time when I actually questioned the official narrative. This was before the post-truth era and Donald Trump coming up with alternative facts and then all of the madness that followed. It seems like there was this glitch in the matrix, which led to the entire world going mad and losing any kind of compass to what we previously knew. I know that you also in Australia had a pretty rough time.
Well, I was going to say, man, those days of alternative facts and, you know, Donald Trump stuff, they seem like a lifetime ago, man. You know?
Yeah, but it seems like at the time, they were laughing at the idea, but they realized that there's value in it. And I haven't heard people talking so much about narratives prior to Donald Trump. But now it seems like everyone has a narrative and everyone has an agenda that they're trying to push to you. And you have to always ask yourself, what does this person want from me or this organization? Why am I receiving this piece of news and why am I receiving it now? Obviously, this has always been the case, but it's a lot more obvious nowadays. Maybe it's the internet that's making it easier to fact check or to hear from different sources. Maybe it's something else, but it was at the time that I had this disconnect when I realized, okay, I have been misled all along. The markets seem to know better. And there's something to this Bitcoin that I did not really understand. So I finally bought some. And I was happy with it. And I was like, yeah, look at it. It's going up. Over the summer, the price went up. But what happened in 2017 was also that there were all of these ICOs and their tokens and their promises and whatever. And it seemed like the entire fundraising industry was being disrupted with this concept that you print tokens out of thin air, you sell them to whoever thinks that you're doing a good job or you're going to fulfill your promises, and then you're going to get rich and hopefully you're going to deliver your promises. So I got misled by that side of the business. And by the time we reached December of 2017, when was the top of that bull market, I think I barely broke even with bad trading and bad investments.
Damn.
I basically chased the pumps, as all newbies do. I was looking at whatever was going up. I was like, yeah, I got to get into this. Obviously, I was losing in most cases.
It sounds like you're at the bottom of the U-turn right now.
Well, what I did after that was to try to rationalize what just happened and ask myself, okay, I have been chasing this Bitcoin idea for such a long time, but I ended up not holding onto the Bitcoin and getting into other stuff. Mm-hmm. And then again, the price of Bitcoin went down. It went to this high, and then something happened. There was this debate. At the same time, there was the scaling debate that was going on. It was too technical for me. I had no idea why I should not read the news on Bitcoin.com and why I should maybe check Twitter more. I was reading both sides of the debate. At the time, it was incredible because Bitcoin.com and r/BTC on Reddit and the @Bitcoin account on Twitter, all of these were promoting Bitcoin Cash, which launched in the 1st of August, if I'm not mistaken, of 2017. And it was a huge distraction. There was this huge debate about which one is the true Bitcoin, which one is following the original scaling vision, which one is technically better, why the Lightning Network is going to change some stuff, what the Lightning Network is. There was so much propaganda and noise in the Bitcoin space. And it seemed like in Ethereum, for example, there were these ICOs and it seemed easier, right? You just invest into this and you hope for the best. Anyway, I lost most of what I gained. And by the time January 2018 hit, and there was the beginning of the bear market, I asked myself, why am I here? What's going on? Did I get into this because I wanted to get rich? Can I actually get rich doing this? And then I got to the point of it, which is decentralization, right? What is that? Mm-hmm. What does it mean? Is this project decentralized? Why is it decentralized? Oh, nodes. What's a node? You basically run and you provide to others infrastructure to access the network. And you also protect yourself from the privacy leaks that you would have had if you connected to somebody else's node. This is interesting. Oh, you can mine. What does it mean to mine? Okay, cool. So you basically exchange your electricity consumption for hashes. And these hashes protect thermodynamically. They protect the Bitcoin network. And in exchange for that, if you get lucky, you get this tiny reward, assuming that you're using a pool and you're not solo mining, which means that you're going to spend a lot of time doing this. So can any project be mined? And if it can be mined, what does the supply look like? Is it fairly distributed? Was there any sort of pre-mine for the developers? Is there any lockup? What's going on? Because at the time, we should put this into the right context, Ripple was still a big thing. It was a big deal. And Ripple was promising to be environmentally friendly, fast, cheap, working with banks, everything you wanted to hear if you wanted to get rich. But what they don't have is decentralization. They have to politically vet the validators, so the nodes need to be approved by some sort of authority within Ripple to say that you're an honest node that plays by the rules. And if you run one by yourself and you're not getting any approvals, it's unlikely that you're going to get recommended for other users to become their connection.
Right.
And there's also a lockup. They pre-mine the entire supply. They release as many coins as they want. They internally sell coins to others, to institutions or whatever. They make deals. So they operate this as a company. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to make any statements about whether or not it's a security. That's not my job here. But it's not decentralized. Also with Ethereum, you have developers who can make decisions. Like five guys get in a conference call and they're like, yeah, so we need to improve this, or we need to get rid of this. We need to change the monetary policy. And then they do it. And everyone else follows them without any kind of questions. Oh, we need to get rid of mining and switch to proof of stake. That happened and the miners gave up very easily. And you have to ask yourself, is this decentralized? Because politically, they're following, without ever asking any kind of questions, these authority figures who seem to be benevolent to some extent, to want whatever is good for the network. But at the same time, it's super risky. And they also set a big precedent with rolling back their blockchain in 2016. So there's also that. So this is what gets you to Bitcoin eventually, and what makes you understand that this is very serious. There is a lot happening. There is no one who controls it. And it's pretty tough to break into this group that's always skeptical, that's always asking questions, that treats you like you're some sort of foreigner, spy, or whatever. When you first start and ask them a lot of questions. I mean, there are a lot of nice people, but there's always this feeling of skepticism, which I perceived as being genuine. It made me understand that these people are for real. They're not just pretending. They're not just LARPers. They really believe in what the mission of this project is, and they're more driven than any other community. I remember I used to like this social media experiment, which was called Steemit by Dan Larimer, who went on to create EOS or EOS later. And it seemed like a cool idea, right? You decentralize blog posting and social media, you upvote and you give monetary rewards to others, except that the pre-mine made it unfair from the get-go. And there were lots of internal fights between people, and this only led to the project disappearing because the incentives were broken from the get-go. Maybe that technically, or at least conceptually, it was interesting and it was doing something, but it could not survive the bear market, and it basically died within a couple of years, for the simple reason that it was not really decentralized and it was not fairly launched. And this is why Bitcoin withstands so many attacks, for the simple reason that there's always someone who's going to run a node, mine it, buy it, ask it in exchange for goods and services. And the longer it exists, the longer it sticks in the back of people's minds, and they're going to be more willing to accept it. I think right now we are living, on one hand, we are under lots of attacks from state actors, from corporations and whatever that try to manipulate Bitcoin and attack it. But we're better than we were back in 2017. At least this is my perception. There are more advocates, there's more education, there are more nodes, there are more developers. The development is more decentralized as many of the OGs have left, and there's a new generation of core developers who are working. There's also this Lightning and sidechain side of development, which is slowly but surely improving. My only issue with Bitcoin is that it's not fungible yet, meaning that it can't really be money as long as you can discriminate socially according to the origins of the money. So we're going to need some way to either stop caring about the origins or else make it possible to hide the origins so that you don't care anymore, just like it happens with cash.
Mm-hmm. There's so much to pull on there, and I'm just curious. No, I'm not curious at all. I'm kind of happy that it took you at least, I think I counted maybe 3-4 touch points before you sort of dove in and actually made, you know, a purchase or at least engaged in it by exchanging some money for this magic internet thing. And that kind of makes me a little happy because, I went through a similar sort of thing. It took me multiple, you know, touch points, more than 4, let's put it that way. And, you know, you had this thing, you kind of, it seems to me like you've critically analyzed it beyond just the NGU tech, you know, the number go up. It's, you're asking all of these questions of it. You were dismissing it out of hand from the get-go, you know, 2013. And even when you were assigned to do that presentation, were you assigned to do that presentation by your professor?
Yeah, it was pure coincidence.
Okay.
It was one of the topics that he pulled from a hat, not physically, but
yeah.
He took some general topics, and the class was about advocating for innovation and to develop our skills in terms of explaining to others why some sort of burgeoning industry is important.
Amazing.
And he had this idea that maybe he should make us present also Bitcoin and blockchain. It was also about, so it was during the bear market, right? And bear markets usually try to present Bitcoin as much more than BTC, the token. Back in 2014, 2015, it was about putting stuff on the Bitcoin blockchain. And that's when we had Counterparty. That's when we had the Omni layer, which in the beginning was putting Tether tokens. So basically they were saying we can put the dollar on the Bitcoin blockchain. So it's not just BTC. Mm-hmm. It's so much more than this. And there's a lot of value to the network. And I don't disagree with that. It's just that technically it's a bad idea to have these assets compete with Bitcoin, the money. And I have a similar argument today when I hear Michael Saylor saying, yeah, we should put the dollar on the Lightning Network because the dollar is freedom and the dollar is whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The currency of the free world, and we should protect that and it should exist alongside Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think that
I disagree only to the extent that the dollar is a currency that causes a lot of pain around the world and a lot of suffering. And if we're going to save that, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's a good idea. Maybe we should just have a different global currency. Maybe it should be Bitcoin, maybe not. I don't know. Maybe Bitcoin will be a niche project for libertarians and cypherpunks for the rest of time. I don't know about that. But I just disagree that we should save this hyperinflating currency that's trying to gain more demand through as many means as possible to prevent the impact of the inflation on the domestic markets, because that's what the US has been doing for decades. They're exporting their inflation so that you don't end up spending that money on their market, therefore not increasing the money supply domestically, and therefore not causing a bigger inflation. That's why they're moving a lot of money to Ukraine, and they're moving a lot of money wherever they can, trying to dollarize the world, because this is their way to export inflation.
Yeah, I get the sense that Saylor's potentially, particularly in more those sort of public comments, is that he's, you know, obfuscating his true intent perhaps and doing sort of a bit of a 4D chess move, you know, as a sort of sly roundabout way to keep the counterproductive class on side, or at least distracted enough such that, you know, this thing can grow and ossify and become stronger, even more stronger, you know, over time. I think that's my take anyway. That's my sense. But I'm, you know, just like everyone, you're skeptical and vigilant at the same time, equal amounts, I think. Why do you think you were open and able to discovering Bitcoin?
So why I think I was open and able?
Yeah, you're open-minded enough, curious enough, it seems. Most people who discover Bitcoin seem to be open-minded enough. And maybe some sort of prehistory, you know, the sort of like pre-Bitcoin, post-Bitcoin kind of vibe where there were things that set you up and it enabled you to discover Bitcoin. I mean, you chipped away at it for a number of years, really, until such time as you pulled the trigger, but eventually you were able to discover Bitcoin. And throughout that whole time, you were at least open-minded enough to entertain reading to the end of the article, shall we say.
Oh, yeah. So there are lots of reasons for that. And I just want to say that all of this will be in my upcoming magazine, which is called Bitcoin Takeover Breaking FUD, which presents the top 10 most common misconceptions about Bitcoin and debunks them. That's the concept. And in the foreword, I explain my journey and how I got to this point and why I don't want other people to go through the same journey. And hopefully they may embrace Bitcoin sooner than I did. It took me 4 years, which was way too long. I wish I got in earlier, except that maybe there was this disconnect in my mind. Maybe I wasn't ready, but at the same time, there wasn't much education at the time. Now it's abundant. You have lots of books, lots of articles, lots of sources that explain to you the basics. And it's also available in lots of languages if you're not a native English speaker.
Mm-hmm.
But what kept me interested and curious was, so of course, in the beginning, I was into speculation and I was thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to get rich and whatever. But then I realized what a void meaning that has. Okay, you get rich and then what? I was writing a thesis in internet governance for my master degree, and I also started a PhD hoping that I would write something about Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Not from the beginning, but after the first year, I knew I wanted to write about Bitcoin. And I ended up dropping out after the fourth year, which was supposed to be my final one, only because I realized that it's not going to happen, or at least not on my terms. I could not, for example, quote or reference something from Bitcoin Talk, which was the origin of the discussion, because my coordinators and supervisors said that it's not academic and that's not a good source. And I was like, this is where it comes from. Everyone else quotes this. Yeah, but it's not an academic source. Wait until some book gets published. And I was like, why can't I be that guy who publishes for
precisely
the first time?
Oh man, I've had that conversations with supervisors in the past. My word. Yeah. Frustrating.
It's just that in my country, in Romania, we are under this, I guess, colonial mentality that we basically comment on what the others have done. We don't really innovate. We don't come up with new ideas or bring them for the first time. We mostly just regurgitate what the others have talked about and commented. And that's why translations are super popular in my country. I've also translated a Bitcoin book 2 years ago. And I did it mostly for my parents because I wanted them to have something to understand why I'm doing this and why I ended up being a PhD dropout and why I'm throwing my life away according to their observation of what I'm doing every day.
Right.
They think I'm a waste and I'm some sort of, I don't want to.
You were on the sanctioned path, man. You were on the sanctioned path. You had your whole life ahead of you. you could have got the degrees, the credentials, the whole lot, and then you realized that the value personally wasn't there, and therefore
I could have been a doctor in philosophy, whatever that means.
Yeah, right.
And if I were a doctor in philosophy right now, I would feel such a strong imposter syndrome, because I guess if I published the thesis about Bitcoin 3 years ago, I wouldn't have known as much as I know today. And I would have disagreed with that thesis. So in a sense, I feel relieved because I did not have to publish anything, because I know that right now I would do such a much better job than I could at the time. And maybe that today I'm much more prepared, but I'm not sure if I still want to get a PhD, because it has no value. What a PhD can do to you is to get you to, so it can help you teach in academia, if that's what you want to do. I thought I wanted to do that. But for this field of study, there is no department. There is nowhere that you can go to teach it. So if there is no demand for it, why bother? Oh, just for the business card. Yeah. I don't care about that.
Yeah, you could put it at the end of your Twitter handle or something. Yeah, it's interesting how you have this concept in mind of a PhD, a doctor of philosophy. You know, it sounds pretty cool. Coming up, I can speak from my own experience with some of my family members, you know, and thinking that was the move, man. And slowly over time realizing that there just isn't the value there that there was back when they were doing it. And, you know, value is subjective. And as soon as it became valueless, for me personally, it was like, forget it. I'm not going to do it. And the thing is, you now have to convince your family, possibly a couple of friends, maybe, I don't know, that you've just switched tack, you've pivoted to something else. And arguably, it's just more valuable to you than the other thing. And that's end of the story.
Yeah, and I'm also part of a family where, of course, Romania was communist until 1989, so I'm part of the first generation that can actually do a PhD without being a party member and without spouting communist propaganda. My parents did not go to university when they were young. They did their university studies after the revolution. Because at the time you had to be a party member and you had to follow a greater purpose that was assigned to you. So you would go to university to become some sort of engineer to work on a project that was being assigned to you from the get-go. Or after you finish university, they would assign to you a job and you had no choice. If they had a job for you in a different city or a different region of the country, they would take you there and give you a house to live, and you would start a new life there. And if you did not want to do this, maybe it was a wise idea to not go to university, because usually, so the spots available in university were guaranteed to give you a job at one point, and a very distinguished and well-paid one. And I think my parents and my grandparents have this idea that if you go to university and have lots of degrees, you're going to end up getting something very good. But I spent so much time there and I spoke with so many students. It's so easy to get degrees nowadays. I think to some extent it became the lazy approach to not embracing life and free markets and the job market. What are you going to do with your life after you graduate from your bachelor? Well, you can get a job or you can get a master degree. What does a master degree help you with? Well, you presume that you know the information so much better and you're more advanced in your field of study. So I did the master degree without thinking twice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not complaining about it. I did my part of learning. But then I started the PhD only because I had no idea what to do next.
Yeah.
And by the time I got there, I realized that the schedule is super relaxed and there's not much to do, you get a lot of freedom to pursue your topic of research. But at the same time, what bothered me was that nobody seemed to really care about my research. I would go and present it to this committee of professors, and they would look at me and be like, yeah, that's nice. Go on, continue, keep on researching. And I was like, well, can I get some feedback, like actual feedback on what I wrote? Nobody was reading what I was writing. And that's something that's really upsetting when you realize that nobody cares. So why should you even bother?
Yeah, exactly, man. 100%. You spend all this time and energy researching, writing down your thoughts, arranging them such that it's coherent, makes sense, not only to you, but to anyone else that's reading it. And not even the committee of professors, supervisors, whomever that are meant to be sort of guiding you through this process are really showing any interest in what it is that you're doing. And then even when they do, when you mentioned just before, you know, the sources of Bitcoin Talk Forum, it's like, that's not a legitimate source. So, you know, then where you're at, it's nuts, man.
All of this experience has led me to writing about Bitcoin, because writing was my best skill. And I think it still is, even though I don't write as much as I used to, but I do these magazines. So I started looking for work in the Bitcoin space.
Mm-hmm.
And I landed a gig at Crypto Globe, which was, still is, a publication which writes about Bitcoin and other stuff. And they gave me the freedom to pursue kind of any topic. It was not very common that I would get an assignment. So I could pursue whatever I thought was interesting. And I was basically writing as I was learning. I think that helped me a lot. The pay wasn't great. I mean, I could not live with that. I still needed another job. But at the time, I think it was excellent for me to learn more about Bitcoin. And it was an incentive for me to dig deeper, mm-hmm. to look for more information, to try to get better at what I was doing, which was to study Bitcoin. And I kept on getting better. And in 1 year, I ended up at Bitcoin Magazine writing. And I was there for about 6 months or something until I quit and decided to focus on my own project, which is Bitcoin Takeover. And since then, right now, I think I have been working on Bitcoin Takeover for 4 years and something with the podcast and everything, but I haven't taken it seriously as the main gig until 3 years ago.
It's a cool project, man. I must admit, I haven't got a lot of experience with it, but I have watched my share of episodes, particularly with your interview with Amir, which I found trying to sort of prepare myself for Eris Foscule's episode on this show. And I really appreciated the contrarian takes that both Amir and Eric have, and that you have as well to a certain extent, particularly on Twitter. It's enjoyable to watch the dialogue between yourself and, you know, the samurai wasabi kind of thing. I don't want to get into all of that, but it's from a learning perspective, from someone who's just observing and trying to figure out, you know, what side you land, if any, it's cool. So you're not just pushing a narrative in the echo chamber. You're doing your own thing, which is incredibly valuable in this space.
Yeah, so just for the record, I just want to say that Twitter is not real life.
Absolutely not.
Remember that. Twitter is not real life. We argue, we troll each other, we insult each other sometimes, but don't perceive that as being what we usually do in person. When we meet at conferences, we're a lot more civil and nice, and we are willing to listen to each other. I think Twitter is the venting place where in between some assignments and tasks, you just go there. And sometimes you write stuff that you don't like. Other times you see something that you don't like and you comment in a mean way. And you end up wasting too much time engaging without really understanding why the other side is acting in this way, what they're feeling or what they're thinking or how they interpret what you're doing. So from this point of view, I think it's a bad medium to communicate. But at the same time, it can be very educational. You can learn a lot from this.
Yeah, precisely.
And I had my fair share of learning, and I'm still learning every day from what the others are posting. And yeah, I don't recommend it to everyone. It's not for those who can't stand insults and whatever. There are some nasty guys around the community. I do my best to not insult the person and if possible, only insult the argument and say, that's a stupid take. Don't say that again. But I'm not going to tell anyone that they're stupid.
No, that doesn't get you anywhere.
Twitter is a great place to learn. But even better than Twitter, there are a few resources that you should read if you're starting out in Bitcoin. And I think the approach that I took and the one that I can recommend is to look into the writings of the cypherpunks. Because they envisioned all of this in the 90s. So there's very little that's being done today that wasn't already discussed at the time. It's only that they could only discuss it conceptually. They did not have the proper means to talk about it practically. But if you read, for example, Timothy May's Cyphernomicon, which is an encyclopedia of cypherpunk ideas, and if you read Nick Szabo's blog, which is called The Unenumerated, and if you look into what Wei Dai and Hal Finney and Adam Back were writing in the 90s, and then you also get into David Chaum, I think David Chaum in the 90s had a very similar concept to Bitcoin. It's only that he named the roles in the network differently, and he had a different idea. It was more centralized in design, but it was so close, and it makes you wonder how much of this is really innovation. It's only basically a practical way to implement something that has already been discussed. And once you go through all of that, you realize not only where the ideas went and what happened to them, but also what else is possible. Because there are still proposals and ideas that were being presented in the cypherpunk culture and under mailing lists that have not been implemented yet. And I think that can be a good way to figure out what you want to do in Bitcoin. If you acquire some skills and you don't know where you want to go, maybe you identify a problem, you can look into the proposal that others have made. It's quite funny. For example, you mentioned Wasabi. I spoke with Adam Fixor, who is the creator of Wasabi. His name is Nopara73 on Twitter. And I interviewed him back in 2019 for the first time. And he was working on this idea of... He's still working on it because it's never a finished project and there are always improvements to be made. But he was working on Chaumian cash, basically. Something that he has read in cypherpunk literature. And I told him, you know, I interviewed David Chaum at a conference 2 months ago. He was like, oh man, David Chaum is still alive? I thought he was dead or something. And it's these funny situations where you might be working on something of which you have very little knowledge in terms of history. So it's very good to spend some time to read this literature because it's where it all started. It's the origins and the intentions and everything great about this space. Even some stuff that went into Ethereum, like NFTs and DAOs, meaning decentralized autonomous organizations, all of these were described on the Cypherpunk mailing list. And I'm pretty sure that they're going to make their way into Bitcoin in a more scalable and elegant and less buggy way in the future. So in a sense, I'm happy that some of these are being part of the experimentation, but there's still a lot that has not been implemented yet. And if you're searching for a purpose in Bitcoin, maybe look into that.
Yeah, early doors spent a bit of time on Nick Szabo's blog, and only recently, really, I think, was encouraged to sort of read a little bit more Cypherpunk stuff. The Cypherpunk's Manifesto by Eric Hughes stands out as a must read, particularly if you're an advocate for privacy. But enough about me. How has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
I think I've become a bit more cynical, which I don't like. I used to be more idealistic in a sense and be more hopeful for the future. But it seems like this experience with crypto in general and all of these broken promises of what it's supposed to be and what the final product happens to turn out as, all of that has made me more skeptical in other fields. For example, I'm more critical of electric vehicles right now, and not because I like the idea of pollution by burning gasoline, but because I realize that just because the end product doesn't have any kind of emissions doesn't mean that the product itself is great and should not be improved further. You have all of these elements that are part of an electric car, which cannot be recycled, and which require a lot of environmentally polluting activities. So basically, Bitcoin has exposed me to a lot of scams. So now I'm a lot more skeptical when it comes to the rest of the world, and I'm more careful. And I usually assume that people are self-interested. I used to believe that everyone is, in a way, very deep inside of them, a nice, benevolent person. Now I tend to look more at the incentives and what they might be after. So I think this is a fundamental way in which Bitcoin has changed me. It made me a lot more skeptical. I used to be very skeptical, but I was also more naive, meaning that I would put more trust into people. Now I verify much more, which I guess is the Bitcoin way to approach everything.
That's really interesting, man, because a lot of people on this pod will describe themselves as becoming a little bit more hopeful for the future, and that they were cynical beforehand. Perhaps they wanted to contribute to some sort of net positive change in the world and kept coming up against barriers which tended to be funded by, you know, seigniorage fiat money. And they discovered Bitcoin and, you know, it enabled them to sort of route around this hopelessness to become a little bit more hopeful. But you've taken that and flipped it on its head. Which is really interesting.
No, not necessarily. So I did not say that I'm more pessimistic.
No, more cynical.
I am cynical, but at the same time, I'm also more hopeful that we at least have means to escape. As a teenager, I was, I think, a lot more depressed. And even when I was in my early 20s, I tended to be very depressed when I realized that I had this feeling of lack of purpose and no escape, because I knew at one point I had to sell out. Okay, I'm doing my studies, I'm doing my bachelor's, master's, PhD, but at one point I knew I had to sell my soul to some cause in which I did not really believe, only to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And when I discovered Bitcoin, I became much more relaxed from this point of view, because I can do some honest work. Honest meaning that I get to express myself and say whatever it is that I want. Some people will claim that I'm dishonest only because I may have some limitations and I don't see their exact same perspective. So they're going to assume bad faith or whatever. But this has done so much to my psyche. I feel a lot more relaxed in daily situations. I'm not going to LARP about Bitcoin changing my life and making it better and whatever. That's what Americans do. I'm not part of the first world. I see some very depressing situations every day of my life. And I'm not even in the worst part of the world, but it's just reality, you know?
Right.
When you step outside, you see... So when you get on Twitter, which we established that it's not real life, you see all of these people saying, yeah, we're building the future, hyper-Bitcoinization. This is so happening. It's going to happen in 10 years. And then you go outside and you see how people actually interact and what kind of conversations they're having and what kind of interests. And you're going to be like, yeah, so do I expect these people to understand that there's inflation in their money and that their savings are screwed and that they should be caring about sound money and that they should hold their own keys and they should become interested in reading something? Because it's very hard to get them to read anything past a headline on a newspaper or on their television sets. It's kind of depressing. But at the same time, I think it's getting easier. And with every wave of adoption, we have an inflow of new ideas. And every generation of Bitcoiners seems to bring in some of their expertise in something. I think with this wave, with the Moon Boys from 2021, we're going to get a lot of artists who worked on NFTs and whatever. So I presume that the user interfaces, once these people grow up and they work on serious projects, they're going to make nicer user interfaces and websites and designs in general. Mm. Also, with the rise of AI, we're going to have nicer graphics for everything. So there's a lot of hope, but at the same time, it's very hard for me to be super optimistic for the future. Also, because I realize that the future is in our hands. And then I look around and I'm like, do I trust these guys that they're going to build a nice future? There was a few years ago this Citadel meme that we're all going to live in citadels and have our own Bitcoin organizations and societies where we delegate roles and we try to live according to the writings of Taleb or some other prominent writers who did this stuff. I always thought it was stupid. The purpose of Bitcoin, the way that I understand it, is to make the world around you better. If you're moving into a place where you're isolating yourself from the rest of the world and you're living with like-minded individuals, that's defeat. That's what giving up looks like to me. When you give up on the world and you're like, yeah, you guys cannot be saved. I'm just going to take everything that I own and move to this place. Also, this place is super vulnerable to bombing or whatever. So if a state actor wants to take us all down, it's so easy. We're all there.
Centralized.
So it's stupid from lots of points of view, but it seemed to spark the imagination of lots of Bitcoiners trying to imagine what they would be like in this sort of community where everyone takes a role. Someone is a butcher, someone is a chef, someone is whatever.
I mean, you describe it like that, it sounds very akin to communism.
It sounds like a hippie commune.
Yeah,
I'll give you that.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it's communism because they want to have free markets. They want to have all of that stuff.
As long as someone wants to become a butcher or a baker, you know, then fine.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. But you know, to isolate yourself from the outside world and bury your head in the sand and pretend that nothing bad is happening in the world. I'm not saying it's wrong if it's what makes you happy, but I grew up in this rougher side of reality where sometimes I like to think of the average person and what it's like to be like that, and to try to think, how can I make this person's life a bit better? Maybe I'm not going to change their situation, but how can I make them think about something that maybe never occurred to them? So to me, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
Right now I'm also working, so it has no relevance for the English audiences, but I'm working on a documentary about Bitcoin in Romania. Mm-hmm. And I want to interview politicians and Bitcoiners and maybe someone from the central bank if they reply to my emails. I've been trying to contact them.
Cool.
But I'm trying to get this broad view of what everyone thinks about Bitcoin from lots of situations and walks of life. And I hope that if it has much more than LARPers who spend all day on YouTube talking about Bitcoin and looking at price charts, it's going to get a broader audience. And even skeptics are going to watch it. So if they do watch it, it's likely that they're going to get an idea of what the other side thinks.
That's so a cool idea,
this
man.
This is just one of the approaches that I'm trying.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing, right? You're out there in the arena trying to do something, building something, creating something that is pushing the progression. And I think drawing lines on charts just doesn't really cut it in terms of creating any kind of meaningful, productive, you know, I mean, it gets people hyped and excited. And let's be honest, when you first come in, the NGU tech's pretty compelling. But the further down this rabbit hole you get, and the more humble and less egotistical you can be, it can show you things that you never even thought of. I mean, for instance, I had some idea that you were from Eastern Europe, but you know, I didn't know exactly where. And it's so interesting to hear that take and that perspective, because here in Australia, you know, we're basically the US light with a mix of the UK. So we're effectively just like Diet West or something. And yeah, you get caught up in your own little echo chambers and you almost have the luxury of time, so to speak, to concern yourself with a fair amount of bullshit if you let it take you. And it did me for quite a number of years until you sort of wake up to yourself and realize that there's infinitely more interesting things out there. And if you can find something to compel you to pursue those things, you know, you should sort of indulge in that rather than indulge in nihilism. So I think the documentary from that point of view, irrespective of whether it's, you know, if you can have English subtitles, so there's a lot of value. You can have subtitles in any language. To making that, to demonstrate and show that there is a side to people's experiences with Bitcoin that are not the rah-rah cheerleading, drawing technical lines, hopium to the moon, all that kind of stuff, which is very cool, man, very cool.
Yeah, thanks. It's just that I don't find much enjoyment in the idea that, oh, you're going to get a Lambo in 4 years if you buy this amount of Bitcoin today. To me, it's silly. Is that everything there's to it? Is this the point of it? Or is there more to it? Is this also about censorship resistance? Is it also about empowering those who might be unbanked? Is it also about escaping the Orwellian CBDC system that's being built? Or are these only talking points to justify the number go up? It's still a dilemma in my head. I'm trying to figure out what people are really thinking, because there's a lot of doublespeak, and we got to a point where I guess we have infiltrations from intelligence agencies or whatever, because it seems like you get these accounts that come out of nowhere get a large following and they say all the right words. They talk as if they have been part of the community all along. And then they suddenly, after they grow a large audience, they drop some ridiculous idea. And some people who are following them are going to fall for it. They're going to be like, yeah, this guy has been one of us. He knows what's up. Maybe that there's something to his proposal. And I'm not even talking about shitcoins. I'm talking about crazy stuff like never spend your Bitcoin, only accumulate. Like, how do you expect someone, honestly, to accept Bitcoin as money if they know that it's kind of rigged and centralized around the hands of a few? You got to incentivize them somehow to accept Bitcoin for goods and services. If it's being treated as this collectible, it's not going to be accepted as money on more markets.
Right. It's peer-to-peer electronic cash. It has to be, you know, traded.
In the Bitcoin design, there's something very interesting because you don't actually own the Bitcoin. You haven't spent the Bitcoin. It's called a UTXO, unspent transaction output. So the network keeps balance or keeps checks of the money that you did not spend yet. It doesn't say that you own. It doesn't say that this is your balance. This is your unspent transaction output.
That is a very interesting way of looking at it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Maybe I should also say it on my show because it occurred to me a couple of days ago. I was thinking, why is it called UTXO? Unspent. Whoa, wait, what? It's clear that this was intended to be used as cash. And if you look at the first mention of Bitcoin on the cryptography mailing list back in 2008, there was this post by Satoshi when he introduced Bitcoin. And then a few days later, there was the first reply by a guy named James A. Donald. And that guy has been very active on cypherpunk discussions. So you can find some of his work on the internet. He even wrote some articles about how he used to be a communist and he became disillusioned. And after joining the ranks and realizing that they're not actually doing anything, he became a free market advocate. But that guy, James A. Donald, outlined two very important concepts that seem to have haunted Bitcoin throughout its existence. So he said that in order for... he first said that it doesn't scale. It doesn't scale. There is only a limited amount of transactions that can go into this system. There is no way to make it absorb the entirety of the financial transactions in the world. That's what he said in a few lines. And then in the next section, he described the Lightning Network. Of course, it wasn't called the Lightning Network, but he said, if you want this to be used as money, you're going to need this. I think he described it as BitTorrent-like network, which is peer-to-peer, and the users transact with each other. And that's what's going to make it scale. BitTorrent, if you have been using that, you don't have to mention that you have been using it, but there's a lot of piracy in Romania, and there was when I was growing up because software was super expensive in comparison to the average wage. So everyone, even institutions in the early 2000s, were pirating their Windows, whatever, and their Office packages, lots of stuff. So there was a lot of piracy in Romania. We downloaded stuff from lots of sources. In BitTorrent, you interact with somebody else who is seeding the information, and you download from multiple peers and you get multiple pieces of information. Of course, that's not how Lightning works, but you get peers, right, with whom you interact, with whom you have channels that are open, and that enables you to have the transactions without actually telling the rest of the world about it. And that's the most important part about Lightning. Because in Bitcoin, if someone makes a transaction, then the rest of the network must know about it, store it on their nodes, and keep it there for the entire existence of the system, which doesn't scale very well. It's kind of a bad design, but it's what needed to be done to not have any kind of double spending.
Right.
This is the solution that Satoshi found. Maybe that there's a better one, but we don't have it yet. But on the Lightning Network, yeah, you don't need to store everyone else's transaction. You only store your own. That's super cool. That's the way it should be. That's what scales.
What have you learned about the world and yourself since discovering Bitcoin?
So what I learned about the world, because that's the first part of the question, is that the media and politicians are not as honest as I thought they were. Meaning that I knew that they were lying, but I thought that at least they had good intentions. But it seems like we are in times where, for example, let's talk about politicians, because I have a degree in political science. I've learned by reading Cicero that you have politicians, you have statesmen. A politician is just someone who plays the political game, tries to get elected into office and gain benefits from it. And the statesman is someone who looks at the purpose of the system, the constitution or whatever, and tries to the best of his abilities to make that work. And I think we have a huge inflation of politicians, but we no longer have statesmen. I think that these politicians are willing to bury the system and destroy it and erode it and shape it according to their own intentions and incentives. Whereas statesmen would be the ones who look at the Constitution and say, you know, we established this system because we wanted this and that. We wanted the people to be secure and we wanted them to be protected from this previous experience that we had. In most countries, it's either communism or colonialism or some sort of relation to some neighbor or country that conquered the territory. So you take it back to the first convention and you realize, why does this still exist? Is it still a threat? It might be. So how do we preserve this? Because we got to a point where it's kind of ridiculous. The states have become too big. And they do lots of stuff that they were not originally intended.
Mm-hmm.
And is that truly necessary?
You mean like telling people not to eat meat or eggs? I mean, that's a pretty large... I think the state's gotten pretty wildly big. It all started out with
the idea that everyone should have access to healthcare. And some people agree, yeah, let's socialize that. Let's pay taxes so everyone gets access to healthcare. Cool. What did they do next? Well, establish more branches and try to basically persuade everyone into following some agenda. Yeah, this is what you should be eating. This is the pyramid of healthy life and food and whatever. You follow this and you're going to be healthy. And then we change it every 10 years or so. And we say it's according to the new science. And then you ask yourself, how did my grandparents live? Or how did they live to 80 or something, or 90? If they were having all of this unhealthy stuff, were they some exception? Am I going to live to 100 because I do this better? Well, there's only one way to find out, but there is empirical evidence that you have gained through generations of existing and being alive on this planet, and you know... Also, genetically, you know what's good for you. And then someone else comes along and says, yeah, that's not what you should be eating. It's something else. Try this. Try grasshoppers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Eat this. It's delicious. It's a superfood. That's a stupid term that they're using nowadays to legitimize any kind of shit that they want you to eat. I don't know. This is a Bitcoin podcast anyway, so yeah. I'm going to try to not...
Good. That was my derailment anyway, man. That was my fault.
Yeah, but this is also a consequence of becoming a Bitcoiner. You become more skeptical about what the others are telling you.
No doubt.
I guess I became more disillusioned with politics than I was before, but I'm, unlike lots of other people, I'm not disillusioned with democracy. I still believe that allowing everyone to have a voice is great and useful, and there's no other system that makes it easy for you to remove someone from office. If you have a monarchy or whatever Saifedean is promoting, it's very hard to remove a monarch who becomes corrupt. You're going to say, yeah, but his kids are going to live in the same kingdom and whatever. He has an incentive to be honest. No. According to history, that was never the case. And there were lots of other noble families that were trying to take the throne. And you had all of these changes of kings and queens. It's really messed up. And in the end, it's the average person who gets screwed. And the average person also enjoys a more limited amount of freedoms under that system. So I can't really agree with something that takes us back to times when everyone was less free. It seems like too many Bitcoiners are complacent in the idea that they have a lot of Bitcoin. And this means that they're gonna be favored by a regime change. So if someone else gets in power and is open to Bitcoin, then they're going to be in a privileged position. And I dislike that for the simple reason that I want Bitcoin to be a fair system as we present it. I don't want this to be only fair for the people who got in early and are going to enjoy the benefits. Of course, anyone who bought Bitcoin early and still has it is going to enjoy some benefits under any system. But that's besides the point. I don't want the world to become, what's it called, an oligarchy, meaning that the richest are the ones who rule.
Mm.
That's proof of stake stuff. I'm not interested in it.
Yeah, and then, you know, that idea of just a bunch of privileged people closest to the, in the king's court, so to speak, you know, and then you've got all the political machinations that go on there, and you have to watch, like, TV show like Game of Thrones or really any kind of period piece on monarchies and to understand that these basic human traits of jostling and conniving and scheming and sort of that Machiavellian type behavior, I don't think it gets obfuscated by having a sound money. I haven't read all of Democracy, the God That Failed by Hans Hermann Hoppe. I've read a little bit of it, particularly the bit at the start around time preference and decivilization. I found interesting, but I'm not made up my mind with respect to democracy versus monarchy. I have it pretty good, relatively speaking, here in Australia. So, you know, till I need to touch that stove, I'm going to concentrate on something else. What have you learned about yourself since discovering Bitcoin?
I used to be, as I said, I used to be more depressed.
Right.
And I realized that life is a lot simpler in some regards. And I used to worry too much about stuff. So I guess I've also learned about myself that I can exist and have a decent living without selling out, which to me is incredible. I don't feel morally corrupt in any sense. I've always followed my conviction, and I've always done whatever I thought was right, and I have no regrets, and it's incredible to have a life, to live your life without having any sort of regrets. Maybe some minor ones, like, whatever, going on dates with girls and messing up. Maybe, I don't know, maybe. But if that's the only regret, I'm super fine with it. For example, I have sponsors on my podcast, right? But I'm the one who chooses them. It's not the other way around. It's not like someone reaches out to me and they're like, yeah, so Vlad, we like your show. How about you promote? I get that sometimes, but I refuse it. It's just that if I don't believe in what you're doing and it's not something that I use personally, I'm not going to bother. It's going to be fake So yeah, I'm really happy with the work that I do. And what makes me even happier is that I get to pursue my curiosities. And in a sense, even though I'm a dropout from university, I feel like I'm doing more research that I would have done if I were still in university and I had unlimited time and resources to pursue it. Not resources, that's ridiculous, because I'm not going to all the conferences and doing interviews in person with everyone and stuff like that. But, you know, I enjoy life.
If you're doing the conferencing thing and the if you're doing it from within an academic framework, so to speak, you'd probably have to spend a significant amount of time filling out forms with respect to logistics and going to places and signing it all off with the deep state of the university, the bureaucratic class, to ensure that you're going to arrive there at a safe time and a safe manner and all of these sorts of things, which detracts from the actual work that you are there for, which is the research and writing to pursue knowledge in and of itself.
Yeah, but I guess that's only true if you expect the university to cover the costs, or if you want to use that as research time or whatever, because I know that you file reports. But if you go on your own money, on your own spare time, I don't think that they're going to ask you anything.
No, they shouldn't. I don't know, man. The administrative sort of aspects of modern day universities freaks me out.
It sucks. I'm happy I don't have to deal with that anymore.
Final question. How do you explain Bitcoin?
It depends on the person and their background and their education. Generally, I tell them that it's the kind of money that cannot be taken away from them and which they can verify. But there are lots of people. You have, for example, the category of people who are very much interested in technology and the future, and they want to feel super avant-garde or something, as if they're using something ahead of the rest of the world. So in that case, you have to show them something with Lightning, and you have to send them a Lightning transaction and blow their minds, telling them, yeah, there's no third party involved, there's no bank, I sent you money and you can spend it to buy a gift card on BitRefill, or you can buy actual physical stuff on ShopinBit, which is like the Amazon for Bitcoin. It's the way to blow their minds. If you're dealing with more conservative types, you have to present them something that they do understand, something of which they have prior knowledge. So it's more delicate. For example, in order to explain it to my father, I had to buy him one of these ballet cards, which are not maybe the best way to do cold storage, but he does understand cards and he likes physical stuff. And I guess the only other option is a Cassasius coin, which is a coin which is physical and has the amount written on it. But that's super expensive. I can't afford that. But I got my dad one of these ballet cards, the Ballet Pro, which actually allows you to set your own passphrase and avoid dealing with any kind of trusted third party. And I think I managed to get him to understand it. He's going to be 60 years old next month. So he doesn't like smartphones. He doesn't like apps. He doesn't like dealing with any of that. He just wants something that you explain to him during an elevator ride or something. And from that point of view, I'm happy.
Yeah.
To the average person who might know about Bitcoin from the news, because they reported when the price goes up or goes down. I think there's more coverage when the price goes down. I explained to them that it's actually a network of computers and it's something that is inclusive and to which anyone can participate. But I'm not sure if they're going to get more interested in this explanation, but it's useful to remove the speculation layer, even if it's a big part, and Bitcoin needs it to resist and survive during the next halving cycles. It's still good for people to understand that there's more to this. Speculation is uncertainty, but there's a lot of stuff about Bitcoin that is more certain than price speculation. The way that it works, the consensus rules, that's a lot more certain. So I try to focus on that so that they understand that it's not some crazy gambling.
I think that's really cool, man. I mean, it is really just who you're talking to, meeting them where they stand. And one of the tricks, or rather one of the things that you develop over time as a Bitcoiner trying to explain it to somebody, is to say less. I mean, when you first dive down the rabbit hole and you begin to think that you're understanding this thing, you just want to blurt out everything all at once, and people just think you're a nutbag. So having that physical iteration for your father is like a really nice anchor for him to sort of, you know, associate this thing as like a real thing, even though you and I know that it's a thing that effectively exists in our minds, so to speak. But having a physical instantiation of this thing helps a lot of people, because, you know, a lot of people shoot it down because of the fact that you can't touch it, feel it, see it, whatever. And the idea of it being a network of computers, and arguably the most robust network of computers on the planet, is a really nice framing as well. Yeah.
You got to know your audience. There is no definitive way to promote Bitcoin. You can give people the Bitcoin standard, the book. They're going to read about it and say, I don't care about the gold standard. I don't care about any of this. I just want money that I can spend to pay for my rent, to pay for my mortgage, to pay for my car, gas, food, whatever. This seems to work pretty well. Why do I need Bitcoin? So you need to adjust your explanation to the person and also give them time. You need to... So I remember dismissing Eric Voorhees' idea that Bitcoin is like a bicycle, and you need to receive a bike as a gift and then try to ride it and figure out. But now I think it's kind of a nice idea that you give someone $5 of Bitcoin via Lightning and tell them, okay, you can either hold it or you can use it for a gift card. You can recharge your phone. You can pay your phone bill. You can do whatever. You can even buy stuff with it. And once they have that moment when they realize, okay, there's a market for this, there's so much more than making more US dollars, I think they're going to take it more seriously.
Yeah, I hope so. Vlad, this has been an awesome conversation, another awesome conversation on this pod. I'm very, very privileged to be able to have conversations with folk like you, to tell me, take me on their genesis story, their tale, tell me the tale of discovering Bitcoin. It's damn cool, man. As I said to a bunch of Bitcoiners over the weekend, it's kind of like therapy for me, having these conversations, particularly these sorts of ones, which you throw out some counter narratives and some perspectives that I haven't necessarily pondered for too long or at all. So I'm very grateful for that and appreciate it. Appreciate you spending your scarce time, finite energy on discovering Bitcoin. Thanks, man.
I appreciate it.